This is Michael Kaiser, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. You'll sometimes hear people describe craft beer as a sort of zeitgeist all its own, coming out of nowhere to upend a century-old domination of the big corporate brewers, rising like punk rock to legendary status by following its own rules, and changing people's expectations for what beer can be. I've described it this way. And a lot of that's true, but it didn't happen in a vacuum. Way back in episode 18 of this podcast with Gary Fish of Deschutes, based in Bend, Oregon, you'll hear a much more contextual perspective. That is, that craft beer, at least in its current form, is part of something much bigger that's changing about the way we eat and drink in the United States. The slow food movement that has transformed so many of the world's dining experiences from city to city, bringing things like farm to table into our common vernacular. Phrases like know your farmer, which sounds a lot like know your brewer, and localvore, which sounds a lot like drink local. All these things were setting a stage that craft beer now dances on. It just happens to be the part in the play where beer is stealing the show. And that brings us to today's guest, Rick Musciano. I first met Rick when he was working at Brewery Vivant in Grand Rapids. Back in episode 10, we talked to founders Jason and Kristen Spalding about their unique community and sustainability-focused brew pub. Rick helped them grow that operation, playing a role in marketing, sales, and operations. He then went on to lead Michigan sales for Virtue Cider in Fenville, Michigan. And then he took the plunge into his own concept, focused on a sort of Nordic cuisine, alongside great beer, wine, and more in a restaurant and garden concept called Sovngarden in Grand Rapids. And in Sovngarden, you'll find the culmination of Rick's former professional experiences, but also something much more fundamental. And that is the influence his parents had on his perspective on food, beverage, and hospitality. They remain an influence to this day. The result is a place in Grand Rapids unlike any other. This is Rick Musciano of Sovngarden. Listen in. All right. So congratulations on having what I think is the perfectly designed restaurant for Hillary, my wife.
You're welcome.
Her being probably the biggest sweetophile I've ever met. I didn't even know that was a thing until I met her. If there was one place we could go on vacation every year, it would be Stockholm for her. And that's obvious. I mean, Scandinavia in general is a huge inspiration for this place. I mean, from not just the decor, which is pretty clear, but all the way down to the cuisine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well,
yeah.
What's the reason for that? I mean, we're in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Why are you inspired by Nordic and Scandinavian cuisine?
Yeah, that's, you know, the crux of it really comes down to what's been happening with the New Nordic movement.
Okay, what's so, that?
Well, it's a literal and, you know, sort of metaphorical movement of chefs in the Nordic countries, and I think it was about 10 or so years ago now, they got together, wrote a literal manifesto of all of these ideals surrounding food that they believed in, a direction that they felt like Nordic cuisine should take. So they organized this movement, and it stemmed from better eating, better sourcing, sustainability efforts, and what blossomed out of it is restaurants like Noma and Favakin, and they started to be, you know, recognized as some of the top restaurants in the world. And it seemed like a lot of that was going back to, you know, roots for them, looking at, you know, peasant and home cooking, looking at the things that were around them. So a very local and regional approach. So that really rubbed off on me when I just started to notice it. I don't think it was an intentional study, but through, you know, amazing documentaries on Netflix and know, articles.
Yeah, Chef's Table comes to mind.
Yeah.
That one where I can't remember the name of the chef that they went to, but way up in northern Sweden.
Yeah, that's Magnus Nielsen.
Right. Yeah.
Yep, so his place is Favakin.
Yeah, okay, that's
right.
That's
the one that looks like it's inside of a cabin in the middle of nowhere, but it's like you sit down for like a 3-hour 18-course meal or something like that.
Yeah.
Something
crazy. I mean, it's stunning. That was probably one of my favorite episodes of that series.
Yeah. Stunning is the perfect word for that. I mean, you're in a very surreal environment, you know, in that country. I mean, it is in the, you know, middle of nowhere, but somehow he's, you know, found this amazing niche. Mm-hmm. and has become a, you know, a world renowned chef.
Yeah. I mean, so you're not a world renowned chef.
No, I'm not.
And you're in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Yeah.
Which is known for, you know, having a pretty good, healthy farm to table scene for its scale anyway. I mean, there's a certain amount of that happening here.
Yeah.
But it's not, I wouldn't call it a mainstream thing like it is in Chicago. Quite a,
it's, yeah, not
it's,
nearly
it's still a very
level.
Small percentage. But clearly you found, you decided at some point that you could translate some of those things you were inspired by at a really high level to a functioning, hopefully profitable restaurant.
We're still working on that part of it. We're not even a year old yet, Michael.
Here in Grand Rapids, which is no small feat. I mean, that's a pretty big translation problem to have to solve.
Yeah.
So what were some of the things you knew out of the gate that you would have to figure out?
Well, just, you know, the reason why this movement was so important was that we wanted to take those ideals and translate them here, mm-hmm. because we felt like the pieces were already there, that the translation could happen because people were already excited about farmers markets. They were already knowing farms and farmers, you know, by name. They were already hyped on Michigan produce, Michigan cheeses, Michigan beer, Michigan wine, you know, spirits, whatever have you. So the excitement was already there about these products. And to me, it was just, you know, taking, you know, looking at that manifesto that they wrote. And if you put in Midwest or Michigan, you know, in place of, you know, Nordic countries, all of those ideas work.
Yeah, they're still possible. Like,
yeah.
The structure's there.
Yeah, the structure's there. So, you know.
But I think it might be questionable whether the interest is there. From a consumer perspective, I think that would be the scariest thing in my mind was, are there enough people that are going to want to do this and want to pay for it?
Right. Well, what we've done is we've taken that more as a philosophical approach. Mm-hmm. So we are not a themed Scandinavian restaurant. We're not like a Danish restaurant or a Norwegian restaurant. I think that if we did that, we would be totally bastardizing those those cuisines and totally destroying the idea that underpins the New Nordic movement, which is you look for the stuff around you, you eat in season, you treat your farms well, you promote better modes of agricultural production, more sustainable modes, things that are good for the environment, better food for children is one of those, you know, ideals.
That's interesting.
So, you know, if we just, you know, emulate what they do over there and we're, you know, sourcing in, you know, Icelandic cod or, you know, Baltic herring, right. Or, you know, whatever, then that doesn't really make any sense for us to do that. So it was taking what we have available here now and adapting that to, you know, to those ideals.
For somebody not from Michigan, give us a sense of like, what are some of those things that are really available here that you've been able to rely on?
Well, something that we've been touting as a state and perhaps not loudly enough is that we're second in the nation for agricultural biodiversity next to California.
No kidding.
And when you think about the difference in, you know, sheer geography, the difference in growing season, it's pretty astounding to think that Michigan is next to California in terms of the sheer variety that we produce. I think volume is another matter, but
still a pretty big volume. I mean,
yeah.
I don't know where it ranks, but it's more than there is demand just in Michigan, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you live in Chicago, and I bet a lot of cherries, a lot of blueberries are coming from Michigan,
yeah.
Sweet corn from Michigan.
Yeah, most of the produce you see in any farm-to-table restaurant in Chicago is coming from Wisconsin or Michigan.
Yeah, and there's a reason for that, and that's because it's, you know, it's awesome to grow stuff here, and you've got a lot of multi-generational farms that have sort of kept to their roots, and that, hey, we're an orchard, like let's carry this on and continue this tradition. You know, a lot of the heirloom apple farmers that I know you've had discussions about with, you know, people like Ryan Burke. They're here and they're producing, and they've always been producing, but for some reason we forgot that those great things were here. So that's really what the Sovngarde is about. It's about joining this sort of stream of consciousness that's happening in the Midwest and saying like, hey, we can be a culinary region just like, you know, Southern cuisine, just like, you know, West Coast cuisine. It's all here for the taking.
It's always been kind of a vague perception I've had of Michigan. Let's compare it to California, because I think that makes total sense. California is so good at taking that infrastructure and then buttoning it up in a way that it can be presented to the everyday consumer as something special and worth their time and money. So the consumer in California expects that high level of produce and, you know, even dairy and animal products wherever they go. So that becomes the expectation,
yeah.
Right? So if you're opening a restaurant in California, you've got to meet that expectation. Those are table stakes now.
Right.
Michigan, even though it has a similar, you know, infrastructure and the producers are there, has never gone so far as to create, you know, it still requires places like this to catalyze that for the end consumer, to present it in a way that makes sense, to tells that story properly, so that people value it in the end. Because, I mean, we're still talking about a value chain. Farms are not in a situation like maybe they used to be 100 years ago, I don't know, of just, you know, if you build it, they will come. Like, nobody's coming. Like, right. Somebody's got to do it at the retail level for people to have a great experience with that stuff.
Yeah, and I felt like that's always where, you know, restaurants culturally have been at their most vital and their most exciting is, you know, this is where the rubber meets the roads, so to speak. This is where you discover new things from farms, or you hear the name of a place like Ham Family Farm, which is an awesome produce farmer that we deal with, you know, here in Michigan. And then people start this process of discovery where they're like, oh my God, like, I've never had this vegetable before, or it's never tasted so good.
And
I think that's why we feel like the work we're doing is important. And it's always been much more about just having a restaurant for us.
It seems like in the dishes as well. So last night I had the chicken and dumplings, which was phenomenal. And there was something so beautifully simple about the way the vegetables in there were presented, where it didn't feel like they were messed with all that much.
Right.
It just felt like they were invited into that dish and to kind of just show off what they were. And I think that's sort of like to me, that's always the magic of when you get ingredients that are that good. At the retail level, you don't have to have anything gimmicky to present them in a way that's attractive. You can just present something as simple as a carrot in a dish, and you're just like, whoa, this carrot.
Yeah.
And that's an exciting experience. But it takes somebody to present it that way, I think, for people to have that flip, that shift in their mind of like what those things are supposed to be.
Yeah, I agree. And I think, you know, again, what is, you know, asking the questions of like, what is the role of chefs and what is the role of restaurants? You know, some farmers do this, but some farmers, like, that's not really their take of it, is like, you know, transforming these, you know, beautiful vegetables or this beautiful carrot into something. Like, they're like, okay, this is on you now. Like, we grew it, like, you go do something with
right.
it. But a lot of times for us, it is that thing of not, you know, frankly, like, screwing it up. Once you get it in, to preserve those flavors, preserve, you know, beautiful colors and freshness. And, you know, frankly, seasonality is something that we talk about a lot here. It's something that is very foreign to us as Americans to eat seasonally. We always talk about asparagus. Like, you know, it seems like asparagus grows year round here now.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get it all the time on any menu. And the fact of the matter is like, asparagus in the wintertime is shit. Like, it tastes terrible. It's not nearly as good as, you know, when you eat, you know, fresh Michigan, you know, spring asparagus.
Yeah, it's all husky and like the texture of it's off and it's just kind of like bloated and tasteless.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So why are we pushing, you know, eating these things out of season? Why are we pushing for sourcing these things, you know, not only out of state, but out of country?
Yeah.
It just doesn't make any sense. It's completely backwards.
Other than asparagus, is there anything that you've had to sacrifice for seasonality? Anything that you wish, you know, like, just makes it difficult to produce what people here would want otherwise?
Well, sort of the double-edged sword of what we're trying to do is that we have, you know, four intense but fleeting seasons here in Michigan. And I think there again, like, there's ties to what happens in the Nordic countries. They don't experience, you know, these long, like, glamorous, you know, summers and, you know, hot weather all the time. So it's things like strawberries that are, you know, here and gone in a matter of weeks that I think, you know, we always wish, you know, we could get more of, and, you know, that the season would be longer. But after strawberries go away, there's other delicious things that are, you know, coming right behind it.
Yeah.
The the experiment this year was like, how far could we take it, you know, really into like the winter months. And I think we did a really great job of, I think, really, really digging into, you know, the cellars and the pantries of, you know, our farms through the winter months. To be honest with you, March was the worst month in terms of, you know, sourcing and product availability. Because you're, you know, at the bottom of your potatoes and all the root crops, and you haven't come into, you know, any of like the early, you know, spring greens and things like that. But really, we're only talking about, you know, 2-3 weeks where we were really jonesing for, you know, some new fresh stuff. But yeah. I think
that's part of that culture too, right? You know, if we're inspired by Scandinavia, is the preservation culture there, yeah, of like how to make things last and be bright and flavorful, even in those weird gaps where there's just like nothing being made, you know, nothing's fresh.
Yeah.
How do you get those flavors?
Right. Yeah, exactly. And this really ties into what all of our, excuse me, what all of our ancestors did, when they settled here, and even, you know, up into like the 50s, like you had a root cellar, like you put up stuff, you know, mm-hmm, was the term for it. You know, you put up beans, you put up, you know, preserves, pickles, and those were the things that people really got excited about. You know, come February, March, was opening that, you know, fresh jar of preserves and spreading that on some bread. And that's, I think, another thing that we've somehow lost in our fast, hot, now immediacy of our food culture that we're experiencing.
Yeah. But is this how you ate at home before you opened the restaurant? Like, how did you eat at home? What was the family food, yeah, life?
Yeah, it was... it was very mixed. So I come from a split family. So my parents were auto workers at Buick City in Flint, Michigan.
Okay.
That's where I was born. Although I can claim none of the hardness of Flint anymore.
No, you're a pretty soft guy.
Right, yeah.
Out here with your fancy cuisine.
I can't claim the mean streets anymore, I guess. you know, very, very blue collar, middle class, you know, upbringing, mm-hmm, low middle class, I would say. But my dad, was always a avid hunter and fisherman, and always had a garden, and really instilled those things, and my mom too, really instilled those things in us, you know, from an early age.
What kind of stuff were they growing in the family garden? Do you remember?
Oh, it was like the classic garden stuff, you know, sweet corn and squash, asparagus. I have a very early memory of my parents had this like freezer, like a, you know, a deep freezer or whatever. And there was, you know, this red liquid, you know, seeping out. And I thought it was like jam or strawberry or something like that. And I took a big scoop of it and put it in my mouth, and it was like beet juice. And
okay. That's not where I thought that was going for a second. That's not, yeah, so
not
bad.
Not deer blood, thankfully. At least I don't think it was.
That would have been my grandpa's freezer, yeah.
Right, yeah. And you sort of came up in that tradition too.
Pennsylvania,
right?
Yeah.
Rural. And that's like what you did. Like, yeah, that was the pastime.
But I slowly saw it chip away though. Cause like when I was real young, like, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years old, we had, you know, we lived on an acre plot in town, but we had an acre, and most of that was devoted to a garden. And I mean, every day we were working on that garden as a family somehow or another.
Right.
And then we moved close, you know, to a slightly bigger town, and we were in more of a neighborhood, and we just had like a little garden patch out back. And then after that, the garden just kind of went away as part of our lifestyle. And before you knew it, like, we were just ordering pizzas all the time. And like it was just, I think my mom still cared about it. Like, she had that little patch, and she loved getting those cherry tomatoes and making salads. And like, that was her thing, but it wasn't part of our family culture anymore. It just kind of like disappeared over time.
Right.
And now I live in Chicago with a tiny little backyard and nothing, you know, like, we don't grow anything.
Yeah.
And so like, it's very easy to let that stuff slip away, even if it's something you grow up with.
Yeah.
Like, did some of that translate to your own, because you have your own family now, you have kids, you know,
right.
Like, do you guys grow things at home? Did you cook like this at home?
Yeah, we do. So we have a small garden right now. But we do live, you know, here in Grand Rapids. I think, you know, we enjoy, different sizes of property than in Chicago and different sizes of, you know, backyards. So, you know, perhaps not apples to apples, but yeah, I think it's something that, you know, maybe for a very short time in college, you know, that living that lifestyle, you know, but for the most part, I feel like I haven't lost sight of it. You know, I would always go back home and really look forward to seeing what my dad was growing. And, you know, we'd go back home on the weekends and, you know, he'd pull some venison out of, you know, the freezer and go out in the garden and, you know, just cook something up, you know, awesome. And it always tastes the best. And my mom, her and my dad, you know, got divorced at an early age, but she was always very much into healthy living, health foods, sometimes bordering on being like a health nut.
Yeah.
So she sat on her local farmers market board for, you know, 6 years. And this is on the other side of the state in the tiny touristy town of Frankenmuth. But those things were always important to her. You know, she never let us, you know, go down the path of complete, you know, junk food debauchery. But, you know, there was times that we would, you know, eat fast food there. And then my stepfather is, he's been involved at one of the largest independently owned family-owned restaurants in the country called Zenders of Frankenmuth. And that's like huge production kitchen, German style, you know, fried chicken dinners, all the sides. So I sort of had that experience too, that that's glimpse great. Into restaurant culture, restaurant life. That's really where I cut my teeth and actually working in a restaurant.
That must have been instrumental. I mean, running a restaurant, if you don't have experience in it, is just like this mind-boggling thing.
Yeah, it's
but you got to see one from the inside out.
Yeah, for sure. I started working there when I was 16. My first position was actually in the back of house, sort of working this like open cafeteria type concept, and got an education from a lot of the older, you know, crusty cooks and chefs there.
They love to give an education.
Oh man, yeah, for sure. And it didn't matter that my stepfather was, you know, an executive there. Yeah. You know. When he wasn't looking, there was definitely some slaps upside the head and giving me the shit jobs. So, I'm thankful for that experience.
That's awesome.
For sure. So I think, you know, my background was very diverse, but there was always a focus on, you know, fresh food and gardens and, you know, knowing where things came from.
So here at Sovngarde, there's kind of a mashup of two things that are really well integrated. There's the sort of, you know, Scandinavian-inspired kind of look and menu and approach to food making, combined with this very German-esque kind of beer garden that stretches out the back, which is really the bulk of the seating in, when it's in season. And it's very, you know, it's very beer-forward here, which another part on your journey on the way to Sovngarde was through Brewery Vivant, one of the better brew pubs we have in the country, right here in Grand Rapids. Tell me about your experience there, what your role was, and how that kind of prepared you for something like this and your approach to beer.
Well, I can't say enough about my time at Brewery Vivant, and you know, big props to Jason and Chris Spalding and what they've frankly done to transform, I think, the small to medium size, you know, brewing industry, especially here in Michigan. So I started off there on the restaurant side of things. So I was hired as their assistant general manager and help them open up their pub and get the restaurant going. Obviously, beer was an important part of what they do there. So that was an important part of, you know, their pub location there. So I did that for about a year there and really got an education on, you know, really everything that they did, from, you know, fermentation to Belgian yeasts. And the exposure, you know, to the craft world was rapid and really exciting to me. Mm-hmm. So from the beginning, I pushed to get back into the brewery with them. I have an arts background, as you know. I studied illustration at Kendall College of Art and Design here in Grand Rapids. So I'm an art kid at heart. And I saw the need that they would need somebody to, you know, sling beer, you know, when they were ready to do so.
Yeah, because they were moving into packaging. You know.
Yeah, they were moving into packaging pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. They had done canning from the beginning. They've been a only canning brewery up until, I think, this past year when they started doing some large format sour stuff and such. So I wanted to be a part of that. I wanted to talk about the brand outside of, you know, those four walls and really talk about the culture that they had created there. So I think, you know, Brew Vivant really saved my perspective on what a restaurant could be, what a business could be. And I think before that, we, you know, tell our employees this, you know, when I train them, is that I didn't want to have my own place, you know, before my time at Brew Vivant. I was trying to escape, you know, the restaurant and bar industry as fast as I could. So I started working there, and it just completely changed my mind on what a company could be, how it could treat its employees, how it could interact with the community. And just the exposure to the beer industry at large was something that was immensely exciting to me.
Yeah, they're really unique. I mean, some of the things that really set them apart are their commitment to sustainability. I mean, they actually give, I think it's like a bi-yearly or quarterly sustainability report.
Yeah.
Based on the overall effectiveness of the building and the business. They, you see that come through in their kitchen as well. Like some of the things that I know you care about, like you see some of those things in their kitchen and the way that they prepare food. And I can see a connective thread there for you, even though you've kind of taken that and run with it. And then there's an obsession or a really keen connection they have to kind of the old world of doing some things there, whether it's the food or the beer or even just what that pub represents in the community. So it's easy for me, I think, from the outside looking in, to see a lot of continuity there for you. And I can imagine how that must have inspired you to really think further about what you wanted to do.
Yeah, it really did. And, you know, I can't say enough about the reception that I felt within the craft community at large here in Michigan and even regionally and nationally. You know, I was exposed to a lot of brewers and brewery reps from notable breweries around the state and the Midwest and the country.
Because you even went so far as to start doing sales for them, I think, for a while. Like you were down in Chicago, like tasting out samples at accounts.
Yep. And that was my primary role there for most of my time. I was their, you know, sort of brand manager. So I was doing sales, I was doing marketing for them. I was using my design background to, you know, create things like ads, and you know, I got to do some beer labels, which everybody wants to do, you know.
That must have been a tough role to walk away from.
It really was.
Because I'm, you know, that sounds like you get to do everything you want to do.
Yeah.
But that wasn't enough.
Yeah, it really was. It was tough. And I think part of being a small new business is that, you know, sometimes you're constrained financially and that you don't always know where the road is. I'm also like the world's worst salesperson. You know, I'd go in and be like, hey, we got this awesome, like, you know, Belgian farmhouse ale. And people are like, you know, what the hell is that?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what this is or care about it. I'm like, oh, okay, well, that's cool. You know,
you just move on.
Later. Yeah. So I would be like, oh, sorry. Like,
no hard sell from Rick Cusciano.
No hard sell at all. Like I hate hard selling. But I think that's maybe part of the reason why, you know, we gained some success is that it was like, this product is here, it tastes really great, and you can get it. You can put it in your, you know, your tap room, you can put it in your store. You know, if you don't want it, that's cool. Like, you know, I'm just gonna move on and talk to somebody that's actually excited about it. Cause, you know, that type of product, like, you need somebody to sell it, and you need somebody to talk about it and be, you know, knowledgeable about it. So it was really hard to walk away from, but we've really maintained a close friendship with them. One of the beers that I think you tried during your dinner last night was the House Sour.
Yeah, the Fooder Sour.
Yeah.
From Vivant. Yeah, that was beautiful.
Yeah, really.
That was the cleanest, most precise sour I've ever had from Vivant. And I've had some good ones. They're mostly barrel-aged up until now.
Right.
The Fooders are fairly new. And that was the first time I'd had anything like that from them.
Yeah, well, I think the Fooders have given them, you know, much more control on like the souring process and like, you know, the homogeneity of like the larger size of those batches that comes out of those Fooders. I don't know how big they are.
And it was only 4.5%.
Yeah.
Like, that was a killer beer.
Yeah. It's amazing. And it evolves a little bit and those Fooders are still new for them. So I think they're sort of like taking on their own personality. And I was in there talking to Brian Kaczynski. He's sort of in charge of the sour program there. And, you know, he sort of affectionately, you know, described each of them with their own little personality. He's like, this one's got a little lacto. This one's got a little more Brett. Mm-hmm. So they're taking like basically like a weeded Weiss beer. And that's what goes into these fooders for the house sour. So it's a blend, and it's not always like exactly the same batch to batch, but they try to, you know, really just nail an ABV, nail a flavor profile. And if it's got a little bit, you know, more of this or that expressing, you know, from batch to batch, you know, that's perfectly fine for us.
Yeah.
It's our house blend, and it's been an awesome collaboration with them, you know, for sure.
So when you say house blend, it's for Sovngarde.
We're one of, I believe, two accounts
yeah.
in the state right now that's getting that.
That's cool.
So it's called Sovngarde House Sour,
you know,
made by Brewery Vivant. So we let them do their own thing. I don't think that there's any need for us to dictate, you know, what the blend needs to be.
It's nice that they have you in mind when they're blending, though, because like they can get into a profile and a spot with that makes sense for the cuisine here.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's so complimentary of the pickles we're doing.
Yeah, it was especially great with the cheese board last night with some of those pickles on there. That was great.
Yeah, it really just goes so well with mostly everything on our menu. So,
GBH is made possible by the financial contributions of our underwriters. Our Fervent Few community, a growing community of GBH fans, including some professional supporters like Hops and Grain down in Austin, Texas, Cloudwater Brew Co. in Manchester, Demos Pizza in Chicago, Four Pier Brewing in London, and the Mitten Bar up in Ludington, Michigan, Yeasty Boys from New Zealand and the UK, and Sound Growler Brewing from Tinley Park, Illinois, all support us through their monthly professional subscriptions. And Guinness, our first major underwriter, helping us bring you a completely new series of stories called Coming to America, featuring upstart and iconic breweries from around the world who are trying to make their way in the US in the age of local. As part of the Guinness Coming to America section, we'll be featuring new wave breweries as well as long-standing imports, like this month's focus on the stateside launch of Birra and Pania from Italy and Australian Brewery. We're thrilled to be digging into these stories, and like this podcast and many of our other projects, Coming to America wouldn't be possible without our underwriting support from companies like Guinness. Watch for more underwriters and new themes like Coming to America in the coming months.
Let's talk about beer in general for you, because I think the list here really indicates for me, like the list you have for a place in Grand Rapids indicates to me that there's a very different thinking process going on about the beer you're serving than I find in any place else in this city. And that's not to say there aren't amazing places in the city. There's quite a few of them, but you're doing something different with your curation and your perspective on beer than anybody else, I think. I see a decent amount of local stuff, but it's not local heavy. I see some great, you know, it seems like you're plucking some things from around the world that are really interesting to you for some reason. Last night I had a mug of Shinerbach, which
I knew you were going to bring that up.
Of course I was. It was delicious, but like to see that on the menu here is there's a certain, I don't want to say eclecticness kind of quality to it or eclecticism. But there's definitely, you're thinking about a few different things when you're putting that list together rather than just, when I come to Grand Rapids, I think there's such an emphasis on local here.
To a fault.
Yeah. Sometimes it feels like to a fault and it gets boring real fast. And I love it when people support, you know, their local breweries, but I like it when I can see choices being made on a list that they're supporting their favorite or what they think are the best or best represent who they are, rather than just local by default. So walk me through some of the thinking processes you employ for putting together a list like that.
Well, I think, you know, something, that you guys have been talking about, you know, a lot, at Good Beer Hunting, and I think the conversation that's happening nationally is there's clearly lines in the sand that are being drawn. And I think if you love beer and you care about beer, you have to care about a lot of other breweries that are not necessarily right around you. Mm. I think there's so many regional and national breweries that are doing so many important things right now that may be large, that may be small. And if you care about craft in general, you have to look at giving them, you know, your support. So to me, that's sort of like the industry side. That's, you know, part of, you know, what I benefited, you know, glimpsing when I worked for Vivant and then, you know, with someone like, you know, Greg Hall and Ryan at Virtue Cider, is that, you know, these guys, they need support. And if they're going to come into Michigan, that means they're excited about the beer scene here. That means that they feel like there's an educated craft consumer here, and let's not screw it up and, you know, prove them wrong that we're only addicted to mediocre IPAs or, you know, average beer styles. So that's sort of like the deeper internal part of it to me, was that we were going to feature the best of what's around here in Michigan. But there was also going to be, you know, very much a national and international flavor to what we do. Part of that was tying into, you know, this Nordic Scandinavian thing that we touch on here. So, you know, you'll see Tuol and Mikkeller, and we have this excellent beer we've been getting from Estonia, from Pohjola. Hmm. And it's things like that that get me really excited. They're a Baltic, you know, brewery, and, you know, we have a Baltic porter on from them right now with
a Baltic porter from the Baltic region. How about that?
I know. Yeah, it's like, why would you not want to try that and bring it in? Like, let's not have like a bastardized style. Like, let's have, like you said, a Baltic porter from a Baltic region. And I believe they put wild black currants in there, and it's just beautiful. And it's just a organic expression of, you know, that style of beer. And to me, that's important to taste that, to expose people to that. And when they have it, their minds are blown. They're like, this is so good. Who is this? How do I pronounce it? It's like, it doesn't matter. Just drink it.
Yeah, that's what happens when, that's the danger, I think, of when local support goes to the point of jingoism, right? Where, like, if it's not from here, it sucks. We don't want it. Keep out.
Right.
Is you stop tasting things from outside your bubble at that point. And, you know, there's a lot of breweries in Michigan, so it's a pretty big bubble. But very quickly, those, like, people can start to tack to each other based on what they're tasting of each other's beers. And your concept of what an IPA is becomes limited really fast because you're not tasting outside of that anymore.
Right.
And that's as dangerous for consumers as it is for producers. I mean, if you're a brewer and you're only drinking things from down the road, your perception of what those products should be and the flavor profiles that are possible, you know, the creative expression of that, it just starts to limit itself really quickly. I mean, that's how you create a bubble.
Yeah.
And that's how it gets really difficult to see outside of. And there's a few markets around the country, like Portland, Oregon, I think, is sometimes criticized for being that way. Although I think they've found a way to be incredibly diverse with the beers that they produce there. So I don't think they're suffering from that necessarily.
Right.
But Michigan has always struck me as one that felt that way a little bit, as a little closed off to what else was going on in the beer world.
Yeah, I would agree with that. But I think the brewers here that are doing, you know, really good stuff, like, they're, if you go look in their fridge, like, there's beer from, like, all over the world in there.
Yeah.
And that's because they have to really keep sharp with their palates. And that's important when they're tasting barrels or tasting fermenters. Like, what are we trying to hit here? You know, what is the best example of this style? Like, let's aim for the top here.
Yeah.
And a lot of times that may not be another Michigan beer that's held up as, you know, the pinnacle of a particular style.
So we talked a lot about Vivant. Who else in the region for you has helped kind of push the envelope on what Michigan beer is? Who are the locals that you tend to bring in the most?
I think recently it's small breweries that are making waves here in Michigan. And I think that's been happening in a place where you live in Chicago, that it's tiny places that are making the most noise. But that is always late to the game, you know, here in the upper Midwest, I guess, we're always somehow behind the punch. But I think, we also have a patience and a willingness to really, like, hone things and put some serious deliberation into things, versus just being a flash in the pan. So it's, you know, my little pitch for the Midwest, I guess. But I think, you know, breweries like Speciation and Transient, even locally here in Grand Rapids, Creston Brewery. Creston's a really cool story because they brew to flavor and not to style. So if you go in there, like, they don't list their beers by, like, IPA, you know, Stout, Lawndale. They have this, like, little icon that they've created to sort of illustrate, like, flavor profile in a beer. And I think they've created some really clean, delicious, refreshing you know, beers over there. So for us, it's like supporting those guys. A lot of them are self-distributed, so they're often a pain in the ass to work with, but it's totally worth it, you know, at the end of the day. And that's really ruffling the feathers of some of these distributors. You know, they're wondering why, they're wondering how, you know, what can we do, you know, to sort of, you know, jump onto this. And a lot of times it's like, you can't really do anything because, you know, you're not small like this. You know, you don't have the flexibility and the athleticism that, you know, a lot of these really small, really cool breweries have.
That's what, I mean, that, to me, that's the irony of that flip, is that we often think of small breweries as being the most vulnerable, right? Like they're struggling to survive. They seem easy to box out of a market. You know, it's hard for them to get on shelves. And that, all of that's very true. The flip side of that is they're so small that most of the big guys, whether you're talking about wholesalers or producers, can't get in their lane. They can't fit into that space and do those things. And so it ironically becomes the most defensible thing that you can do, is stay. If you can find a way to sustain yourself very small, doing the exact things that you want to do, chances are none of the big guys can come after you because that lane is so tiny they can't get in there.
Right.
Especially for places like this. Like, I mean, as much as it is a difficulty for an account like this to work with lots of different self-distribution reps, because you're taking many more meetings a day, you know, schedules are always conflicted or weird, or, you know, or things are showing up a day or two late and things like that.
Right.
It so fits what your concept is and what you're about and what you're trying to offer your customer that it's worth the trouble. And when somebody, you know, the larger somebody gets, whether a producer or a wholesaler, the trouble is what they're trying to eliminate. They're trying to eliminate the friction, but ultimately you're willing to put up with that friction to get what you want. And so there's just no value proposition there.
Right. Yeah. We're absolutely willing to put up with it. And it's a pretty minor thing, like when it's all said and done.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're talking about beer at the end of the day here. We're talking about liquid that goes in your glass. And to me, it's the flavor and the quality that should always be, you know, the most important things. Like, I don't really care if, like, you know, this thing in your portfolio is the number one seller, or, you know, nationally or statewide, it's doing this numbers or that numbers. Like, to me, that doesn't really matter. What matters to me is, like, this beer was literally pulled off of, you know, the Bright Tank and carved up, you know, 2 days ago. And it kicks ass, you know, when we're, you know, drinking it a couple days later.
It almost sounds like that's how you think about working with farmers. I mean,
yeah, and that's why
it's more work to do. It's more work to do that, but you're getting the thing that you want that nobody else is putting in the effort to get.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we take deliveries almost every day here in the kitchen. And frankly, that is a pain in the ass to order, to work with, to deal with all of these different people coming in and out. Could we get everything, you know, dumped off of a mass distribution, you know, food truck? Yeah, we could. But, you know, then why are we even doing what we're doing? Then we're just a normal restaurant. So we take the same approach, you know, with our beer program.
Yeah.
It's handpicking things. It's being intentional about curation. And, you know, the things that are the smallest production are also the most sustainable and have, you know, the least footprint. So there's that sort of element too that ties back into, you know, our personal and business sustainability goals. And I think there is something to be said about supporting these guys too, that is much needed in our industry right now.
Yeah, it'd be lovely if at the end of the day, all of that inefficiency and trouble and effort would mean that someone would pay double for it, but they won't. Like, you looking at your menu, your prices are right in line with what you would expect going to any bar or restaurant in Grand Rapids. Like, you have to do all of that and still hit those numbers.
Yeah. Am I not paying double? Sometimes I am.
Oh, I mean, you might be, but your end customer is not.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think one of our friends that was dying with us last night commented on, like, you spent a lot of money on glassware here. And we did. And that's, you know, part of a personal thing that I like to do, and, you know, presenting beer in a nice, you know, appropriate glass, but also we're able to, you know, just adjust, you know, pour size and things like that to give people, you know, a good price. It doesn't always have to be a 16 ounce, you know, shaker pint of a double IPA. So
yeah, that helps.
Frankly, shouldn't be.
I mean, so this is the first season I've seen the garden open, which is a big deal. So this used to be, I mean, describe the physical situation here, because I think it was kind of unique where there was just this back lot that was just like a gravel slope. There was nothing there.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, we're sitting in literally like a basement garden level of an old historic building on a west side neighborhood of Grand Rapids. So traditionally like a very blue collar area of town. It's been neglected for a number of years. And when we started looking at this neighborhood, you know, there was long stretches of these old retail corridors that were boarded up and vacant or been demolished. And we knew that we'd fit right in with that. So, So
with your fancy Nordic manifesto.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Made total sense. But I live in this neighborhood and we wanted to invest over here and make it look better and give people, you know, more choices. Not be elitist about, you know, how we price our menu and, you know, how we price our beer and how we position it. So the beer garden was the idea that came first for the Sovngarde. We wanted the communal space. We wanted it to be visible in the neighborhood. We wanted it to be a gathering spot where people from, you know, any walk of life could come down and hang out and have a great drink and a reasonably priced, you know, plate of food. And I think we feel like that's necessary to provide that, especially in a neighborhood that was neglected, you know, for a long period of time.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to drink beer outside in Grand Rapids, there aren't that many places to go. I mean, seasonality doesn't make it all that, you know, all that smart from a business perspective, maybe.
Right.
But Founders is one of the few, you know, and they've got fire pits out there.
Yeah.
To extend that season a little bit. But there just aren't that many places you can have that experience in Grand Rapids.
Yeah, you're right. But if you do have a spot, people want to come out to it, like, you know, every day. So that's sort of what we were banking on, is like if you create like a sweet spot for people, you know, just to hang out and have some awesome stuff, like we thought people would come, and that's proved right so far for us. So we took this vacant property that was behind the building, and it was pretty much just like a weedy lot. I think there were some houses back there at one point that were demolished. But it was a literal, you know, dark corner back here. There was a stolen car that was stashed back here at one point, according to our landlord, and, you know, hypodermic needles, and I found a knife back here. So it was, it was not pleasant back here.
Yeah, it was rough.
Yeah, for sure. And it was just underutilized. So, you know, we knew it was a perfect spot for the beer garden. Grand Rapids is going very much through a boom right now. So we knew we also wanted to preserve like this green space in the middle of the city. So we've tried to make it very lush and sort of feel like you're stepping out of the city for a little bit. I can't tell you how many people that have stepped down here and they're like, man, I feel like I'm in Copenhagen or Stockholm right now, or I don't know where I'm at, but it doesn't feel like I'm, you know, in the city, which to me is mission accomplished, you know?
Yeah. And since you've started this project, what's happened in just the few blocks right around you is astounding in terms of development. New Holland space, the Knickerbocker went in, which is just this massive development for them. It's gotta be one of the biggest brew pubs in the country right now in terms of seating.
Yeah. It's crazy.
And there's a bunch of condos that are being built all around and like big lofty modern condos. I mean, the rents in Grand Rapids right now are higher than Chicago. That's insane.
Yeah.
I mean, people are paying over $2,000 a month to live in Grand Rapids right now. And that happened within 2 years.
I mean, right.
Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, you picking this spot, if you would have waited six more months, you wouldn't have gotten it.
Yeah, I don't think so. And there was a lot of restaurant people, bakery, coffee shop people that are like, yeah, I looked at that spot, but it was really weird. I'm like, yeah, it is.
Because there was nothing over here, really. Just a couple of old dive bars.
It was a dirty, creepy basement. But as soon as I stepped down here, it was like, yes, this is it. Like, you know, we talk a lot about, you know, hygge is like a big, you know, Danish, you know, Scandinavian thing. And, you know, it's a word for familiarity and coziness. And, you know, it's one of those words that's hard to define here for us in the States. But to me, like, you know, a underground, you know, beer bar with, you know, secret beer garden in the back, you know, seemed, you know, like the perfect thing, you know, for what we were trying to do. But yeah, you're right. This neighborhood, I mean, we certainly cannot cannot claim to have started this. I mean, I think this was in the works long before with forces much larger, you know, than ourselves. You know, there's, as you probably know, there's quite a few, you know, wealthy families here in Grand Rapids. And for better or for worse, you know, they're pushing this city along. And I think
they seem to think it was Grand Rapids' time. Like it could, yeah. The push seemed kind of simultaneous within the last few years.
Yeah, for sure. You know, New Holland is built on the ruins of an old porn shop, Cine Mini.
Knowing who the wealthy families up here are, I would imagine that they revel in the fact that they replaced that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, all the churchgoers are singing hallelujah. You know, except the ones that went there, you know, secretly.
Secretly, right. Yeah. Have your parents been into to dine?
Oh yeah, for sure. So my mom and my stepfather are my business partners. So they've been immensely important. My stepfather's 40 some years in the restaurant industry has been immensely important. He's been the sort of advice, you know, financial, you know, backbone, really guided me, you know, in the early days of my business plan, really, you know, helped broaden my scope of, you know, what was possible, what was important, you know, what we needed to do to succeed, you know, as a business. And, you know, we're sitting here, you know, 11 months of being open. So we're still very, very new and still trying to figure things out, and still trying to figure out our place in this neighborhood. And that's, you know, that's sort of the larger discussion of like what's happening in Grand Rapids of like, you know, a New Holland and, you know, there's rumors of Jolly Pumpkin coming in, you know, high end condos, high end rents, in the middle of still very much a working class neighborhood. Like you go a few blocks down and there's Polish people that have been living there for 50 years. There's a big, you know, Hispanic and African American, you know, population on this side of town. And I was just talking to one of our, you know, new servers about that. They live over here. They did not get a very warm welcome to the new apartment that they, you know, moved into with some other ethnicities, you know, in their same, you know, apartment building or next door to them. And I think that's part of the larger discussion of what's happening, you know, in the city right now. Like, is there too many breweries? Is there too many, you know, loft style apartments? And where are we going, you know, with the city? We want to be part of the solution, and we're trying to do that through, you know, beer and food. But sometimes it's hard to figure out like who's on, you know, what side and what the best solution is to, you know,
those forces are
like,
big.
Yeah,
and they've been around forever, and I don't think anybody's ever figured it out.
Like, no, they
haven't. The one thing that's true is that the money keeps pushing.
Right.
Like if there's opportunity, that's the momentum. And it's really tough to figure that out along the way.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes this town unique. And, you know, Grand Rapids historically has just sort of flown under the radar, you know, underneath Detroit. And I still think, you know, for all the things Detroit has gone through, we still have a lot to gain to catch up to them in terms of immensity and importance, you know, as a city. Beer has certainly spurred that on here in Grand Rapids, but that can't be the only thing. Man cannot survive on beer alone, right?
That's close.
Right.
That's close.
Maybe. The monks prove differently, right?
Thanks for listening this week, folks. This past week, we published a critical drinking piece by Brian Roth examining the still dominant role of IPAs in the U.S. and increasingly around the world, called What We Talk About When We Talk About IPA. It's a fascinating read. We also published our latest Fervent Few community article, sharing perspectives on the role the adjunct lagers have played in our lives and how we think about them differently now as more and more craft brewers are re-embracing the style. If you weren't already aware, we started a subscription club for GBH readers called The Fervent Few, where you can contribute financially to the content you love and get access to exclusive gear, our community forum, and we invite you to share your experiences and opinions on a weekly topic. It's been a great way to bring our readers together with our writers for some compelling discussion. You should join. If you'd like to support GBH, we use Patreon as a way that our readers and listeners can subscribe with a monthly contribution, just like subscribing to a magazine.
visit patreon.com/goodbeerhunting or click on the link in our show notes. Our music is produced by Andrew Thibodeau, and our sound engineer is Jordan Stalling of Particle Audio. Aim true, pour liberal, folks. Have a great week.